This is First Cast.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to First Cast.
This is Connor Ryan from 1403.
This is Adam Richards from 1341.
This is Joseph Matt from Dayton, Ohio, giving a shout out to Kristen from 639.
This is Jeff Rodriguez on 173.
And this is John Vineyard.
We're here to bring you episode 3 of First Cast. Okay, so let's get started for this week's episode.
All right, hey everybody. Many of you might have noticed that First has a new president. His name is Paul R. Gudonis. He was a CEO of a company. He serves as chairman of the Massachusetts High Technology Council. He's a director of the Massachusetts Network Communications Council and a member of TechNet, a national organization of CEOs working to increase the number of science and engineering graduates in the U.S. What do you guys think about this?
I think it's an interesting move. It's good to have a president again, at least a full-time president. Shows commitment, and I think it might help with the business aspect since he has a lot of background with it. So it might be more organization on First's part. I think it's a good move.
He certainly seems qualified, and I just wish him the best of luck.
All right, I got to bring this up, though. Did anybody here actually know that First had a real president?
The president's actually a new position. He's the first president, as you know. Amusing as that is, he's replacing the role previously filled by Paul Shea.
Interesting. All right, moving on, I believe Matt has something.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone's heard about the new regionals by now. We mentioned them last week. This year, things are being a little different, though. Some regionals are filling up faster than they usually do, and some of them aren't. I've seen some that are full up by the end of the first week of registration, they're still open, and some of them that I saw almost never fill are full. So, I mean, that's surprised me a little bit. And a few people mentioned something to me. Some teams are not signing up for the usual regionals. So, it seems like an interesting year for regionals. Everything's been shaken up a little bit.
I think it's actually pretty interesting so far. One of the key parts of conversation that's going around right now is the fact that Waterloo is so empty. I think only 2 teams are signed up right now.
I'm sure that won't last long. It seems that most Canadian teams take Greater Toronto because it's such a large regional and it's proven that it's a good regional, and then they'll all go to Waterloo after that. I don't think they'll have any problem filling it up.
I agree. I think both of those Canadian regionals are going to be absolutely incredible, especially because Toronto is going to be back to 2 fields this year. That's confirmed. Waterloo it was supposed to be a great regional last year, even with the low turnout, so I imagine that it'll be an excellent event. I don't know if any of you guys have actually been up to the Canadian regionals, but they put on a heck of a show.
Also, another regional, take a look at down in Florida, UCF.
Oh, God, my home regional. Yeah, this is going to be very fun. I believe we have Gumpa and the Herd coming down all the way from Massachusetts.
I also saw that Team 61 from Massachusetts. Seemed that there was more teams than usual traveling down to Florida. It's only really going to make it a better regional.
I think 61 perennially travels down there. I'm not sure when the last one they missed was.
Okay, I just don't pay attention. That's why we got John here.
But seriously, guys, I think that Florida is going to bring a national champion this year. I know I'm hopeful, but come on. Whoever wins Florida, I think, is going to win the national championship for the first time.
You guys know the only team you can bet on this early in the season from Hammond, Indiana.
Is this going to be like a reoccurring, see how many times they get mentioned in each episode thing?
Okay, let's move on again. Did anyone see the thing that Autodesk put out? Offering free inventor workshop. Those of you guys don't know that Inventor's doing about 15 or so training sessions that are all day. First Robotics hands-on training, particularly using Inventor. They're really cool. If you haven't signed up yet, or try to go see one, because it'd be really useful, and everybody on this show can tell you how useful CAD is when designing a robot.
Yes, CAD is definitely very useful, just to see how things might look afterwards, and I know I CAD a few parts of a robot last year, and we picked up some major flaws none of us foresaw. It saved us from having a rough time.
Yeah, right as of now, the ones I've concluded so far are New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and they still have openings in Texas, Illinois, Michigan, Florida, Georgia, California, 2 in Canada, 1 in Virginia, New Hampshire, and also another California. So there's a pretty broad spectrum of places where you can go to get these workshops.
Okay, I guess moving on for our first guest on First Cast. Joe, are you in there from Dayton?
Yeah, I'm in here from Dayton.
Okay, so for those of you guys that don't know yet, Joe's known for working on his Care First project. Joe, can you tell us what that's exactly about?
Yeah, sure. Care First is basically an idea of bringing First and its ideals to
kids and other people who cannot traditionally participate in FIRST programs. Those who can't go to high school, those who are not located near high school, or even Hurricane Katrina victims, as recently happened.
So how exactly do you guys help these people?
Well, the whole idea about Care FIRST is that it's open-ended. So basically, we put the ideas in, kind of like what FIRST does, but we try to keep it open, but we do provide what we did. When I was on 3D4 last year, we went to the Richmond Children's Hospital in downtown Richmond, Virginia, and we helped demonstrate with FIRST LEGO League. We brought down Sparky 4 and 5, and we did various other things like that. This is all available in our manual, which you can get at sparky384.com/carefirst.
Awesome. That sounds like a really cool program right now, and I think it can really help out some people, particularly with Hurricane Katrina. It'd be interesting how much use it gets this year.
Yeah, I agree. I really want to see what's going to happen. Unfortunately, I'm not part of my team anymore because I'm like 10 hours away. So I'm really interested to see what happens. But if you want more information, I definitely suggest going to our website, sparky384.com/carefirst, not to put another plug in, and also try to contact Carol Cotton, she's the head of that, or Marshall Turner, the head of 384.
Okay, another thing that Joe's member of, Joe, you got a FIRST scholarship last year, right?
Yes, I got the FIRST scholarship to the University of Dayton.
So how does that application process go about, and do you have any tips for the upcoming seniors, like Matt here?
Yep, tips are good. I definitely need tips.
Yeah, I have plenty of tips, and I'll give them out to you. First of all, the best thing you could do right now is just go to the FIRST website and see what's offered. Chances are some place near you offers a FIRST scholarship. I know there's FIRST, VCU offers a regional scholarship right there, one in Dayton. Drexel offers one, I believe. They're all over the place. So check there first and then see which schools match up. The best thing you could do right now if you're a senior is to see what school matches up with your personality. Don't go necessarily to the school that, you know, it's like the most prestigious or which one, you know, has the highest grades or whatever. Just go there, see what matches up, and then choose based on the scholarship. And even if they don't offer a scholarship, make sure you choose who matches up with you, because nothing's worse than going to a college you don't like. I know this has happened to some of my friends. The next thing you should really do is apply early. I applied like the day it was due. So don't do that. Don't run up to like the post office the day it's due like I did and hopefully it gets submitted. You don't want to do that. Also, make sure that you fill out all the applications completely. Some of them require a worded essay that you may need to complete. It may not be the same as you have to submit to colleges, so you want to get that done too.
Good tips. I'll keep those in mind. As far as college choices, I was actually considering following in John's footsteps and going to Clarkson. Seems like a pretty good school for me. John, you've known me for a few months now. Do you think Clarkson's a good match for me?
I don't know, Matt. Your best bet is to go up there and check it out and see if it fits. I know you can probably arrange to stay with someone on campus and get some of the college experience for a weekend. I know I did that when I was looking at schools. I went and stayed in dorms for a couple nights and just tried to get a feel for the school. I agree completely with Joe. The best bet for anyone trying to decide in a college is to just make sure you're picking the school that's best for you. As far as scholarships goes, again, there's lots of FIRST scholarships out there. It's interesting to note that a lot of them go unfilled. So to all those people who are, you know, saying, oh, well, I'm not going to win that, or, oh, I don't feel like filling out the applications. You know, you're just passing up free money. Take the time, apply, and see what happens.
Just to mention a couple of the schools that offer some scholarships, like Clarkson, up by 229 up there, Purdue University, Dayton, a bunch of others. Boston University, the site of the Boston Regional this year. Rochester Institute of Technology, a bunch of great schools. Definitely take a look at the link that US FIRST has on their website and apply soon. Guys, Joe said it enough. You guys got to just make sure you're on time with all your paperwork.
Yeah, I agree. And also just to throw in one more thing, some of the scholarships require you to be part of either the engineering or a specific type of engineering. So make sure you check to see what the requirements are. They may even have to deal with race or sex, depending on what the scholarship requires. So make sure you check that, too.
So, Joe, how'd you pick your schools? I mean, you know, you both got these FIRST scholarships to your respective schools, right?
That's right. I got a scholarship from Clarkson University, which is $6,000 per year for all 4 years of my education. I did manage to finish in four. A lot of people were kind of wondering about that. I chose Clarkson based on it just was the right fit for me. It's a community atmosphere. They emphasize, you know, project-based, hands-on learning, which is great for me. It's very friendly. All the professors are very friendly. And it's a small school, and that's the kind of thing I like. I don't want to be, you know, one in a million. The location isn't great, but that wasn't high on my priority list. I mean, some people have to be in the middle of the city. You know, they really want to be in Boston or New York City. My brother goes to Columbia University in, you know, downtown Manhattan, so obviously he wouldn't be a good fit at Clarkson. But, again, just go where it feels right.
Again, one of the reasons why I chose Dayton was because I'm originally from Cleveland, so I know the Ohio area quite well. So that was one of the reasons why I checked it out. I also liked their engineering program. Just, it looked really, really nice, and I liked it, so that's why I chose it. I got accepted in numerous other schools, too, but I think Dayton was the best choice.
I'm wondering, do you guys have any tips or checklists or something to run through to help pick your school? Because it looks like I'm going to be up in the air between 3 or 4, so anything you can do to help me pick it or other first-years out there.
Well, the first thing you should really do is that you're probably going to have 3 or 4 schools that you're going to really like. That's what happened to me. And frankly, you're going to probably be good going to either one of those schools. But when it comes down to it, what really drove me to Dayton was not only that it was the nicest, I thought, and it fit me the best, it was also that they gave me more money than all the other places. It's a private institution, so unlike one of the other places I get accepted to, Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, they could give me more money, which is really important right now.
Again, go visit the school, you know, take a look around, talk to the students, try to get past the fuzzy exterior and learn more about the actual school. Talk to professors. A lot of schools give you the opportunity to schedule an interview with professors in different departments. Going there and talking to people is the best way to learn about it. I mean, you really should make an effort to visit the top few on your list, if not all the ones on your list.
All right, moving on, I believe Jeff has a segment on history once again.
All right, thanks. This week we're going to cover 1999. Going back then, there were 268 teams in the program and 8 regionals. So you can see how big First has gotten and how quickly it's gotten to that size. The game that year was called Double Trouble. It was actually the first year that they introduced alliances into the game. Before that, it had been every man for themselves. And then in 1999, they made it 2-on-2. The playing field was also much smaller. It was 28 feet by 24 feet, so it was more like a square, not as rectangle as it is now. The main object on the playing field was a 5.5-foot diameter octagonal puck. The puck was 6 inches high. The whole surface of the puck was carpeted, and it had 1-foot pipes sticking out of the top surface in opposite corners, so robots could use those pipes to latch onto the puck and maneuver it around the field. The scoring object that year was what's now known as floppies. They were circular pillow objects about 2 feet in diameter. Around the outside edge, they had a strip of Velcro, and they had another spot of Velcro right in the center. So the robots would use the Velcro to pick them up and carry them around the field. It was a 2-minute match. This was also before autonomous modes, so the entire 2 minutes were driver controlled. Alright, so we got this square field, big puck in the middle, these weird floppy things. What do we do with it all? Well, the field's divided right down the middle. Now, that line basically represents different sides of the field. If the puck is on your side of the field, it would double your score. If a robot was on top of the puck, it would triple your score. Now, all this only counted at the end of the match. They didn't take into consideration in the middle of the match. So how do you score base points to be able to multiply it? The floppies, if they were raised 8 or more feet in the air, they were worth 3 points. If they were 1 point, or they were worth 1 point if they were just off the ground. So they have to be at 8 feet, basically at the lowest point, to score the 3 points. Alright, so let's give an example here to try and score this. Say your two robots, the puck is on your side of the field, you have one robot on top of the puck, 3 floppies in the air, 8 feet in the air that the robot's holding them up, and 1 floppy sitting on top of the puck. You guys may have to help me do the math here, but 3 floppies in the air, 3 points apiece, 9 points. 1 floppy off the ground. The puck was considered off the ground 1 point. So that's 10 points in floppies. The puck on your side of the field doubles that score to 20. The robot on top of the puck triples that score to 60. That kind of sums up the game for that year. This was my first year involved in the program, so my memories are a little bit fuzzy, but I can try and answer questions, and we got John here. So, you guys got any questions?
Seems like a pretty complex game. Do you think it was a bit harder or easier than the past year's 2005 game, Triple Play?
Then 2005, I would have to say, it's probably right along those lines. 2005 was a very strategic year. You know, strategy played a big part with, you know, the whole tic-tac-toe thing. In 1999, it didn't have as much strategy, but it was still fairly hard. And, you know, with the multipliers, through the puck and a robot, could basically, you know, at the end of the match, swing the score way into the other team's favor, even though for, you know, the first whole part of the match, you could have been dominating.
Okay, so all this talk about the different things. So, any particular robots that stand out years ahead of its time and stuff?
There's one robot from 1999 that you just can't not talk about, and that is TKO, which was the Technocats robot from that year, which was literally a boxing glove on the end of an arm, a real mean arm with those mean Technocat tracks. I mean, this robot was the ultimate defensive machine from that year. They actually partnered up with Wildstang at Nationals and went on to take the silver. They actually got defeated by an alliance of Team 1, the Juggernauts, Team 176, Aces High, and Team 48, Delphi Elite. But, man, they came close.
Living in the Northeast, I remember the 176 Aces High robot, and I think out of all the robots I saw that year, it played the game the most fluently, you know, picking up the floppies, getting on top of the puck, raising them in the air. It just seemed like it could do it easier than a lot of other teams.
The floppies sound like a really unique game object. What was your favorite type of lifting or carrying device that carried the floppies?
My favorite of the floppy mechanisms was the floppies actually had some Velcro strips on them. So one of the most creative floppy grabbers was Team Hammond. They actually had a conveyor belt made out of little Velcro tongues. So they would just drive around the field, sucking these floppies up into their basket. And it was an incredible thing to watch. It was very fluid and fast and just really impressive.
Any particular, like, drivetrains or something else that might stick out in that year?
Really, the only thing I remember from that year was wheels of robots. A lot of teams had basically, you know, giant gears for wheels. And as the robot's driving along the field, it might, you know, be bumping a little bit. But it really allowed them to just roll right up on top of the puck, because the teeth on their wheel would just grip the surface of the puck, and they'd go right up on top of it.
As far as drivetrains go, there were some interesting swerve drives that year. I know I wasn't actually a participant in this season, but everyone talks about Chief Delphi and Wildstang both dancing around the puck at Rumble at the Rock, where they would both latch on and they're both swerving back and forth and spinning around. It was supposed to be an amazing thing.
Alright, so I'm sure some of you viewers wonder, is there anything we do besides robotics? And personally, not for me. If I'm not talking about first, I'm working on my VEC stuff. I'm wondering, what is everybody else doing right now besides recording the show?
It's gotta be iTunes. Lots of music. I think my library takes about 8 gigs.
Only? Oh, come on, I'm way past. I'm about 12 gigs right now. Some days I go up to 18, depending on what I'm listening to and which computer. Outside of robotics? Let's see. Nah, nothing really.
Well, I know, John, I believe he's still at the IFI offices. I'm wondering if he's working on anything. Are you working on anything, John?
Well, I'm just kind of sitting at my desk right now, and I do have SolidWorks open, and let's just say I don't know why Lavery wants a waterproof speed controller, but we're sure as hell going to deliver by kickoff.
Wait, did you just say waterproof speed controller?
Oh, that's not very nice to leave us hanging like that.
Wait a minute, why do we need a waterproof speed controller?
Well, the RC was real easy to waterproof because that's kind of sealed up, but man, that Victor's so open, it's just tough. We got a couple designs in the works right now.
So let's move on to this. So, they released the first VEX Challenge pilot game this year. What do you think of that, John?
I think it's a pretty exciting game. For those who haven't seen, the game is called Half Pipe Hustle. Basically, it's a field with ramps on either end where VEX robots compete to pick up and and score racquetballs and goals. It's pretty interesting. You can learn more about it by going to usfirst.org/vex, and they have the game manual up and posted.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at the game manual now. What I find interesting is the way the robots start on a slope and they go down the field. I don't think there's ever been an FRC field like that, was there? Or do you expect we'll see one soon? Because it seems pretty interesting.
Well, it's probably a little easier to build a half-field ramp on the VEX size than it is on the FRC size. We do want to keep our fields affordable. I don't think every team's going to be able to build a giant, 24-foot ramp.
Well, I mean, like, in 2003 Stack Attack, we built half the ramp. I mean, how much did you need? We built only one side of it, and we only made it half as wide as necessary. Actually, we ended up building the other side anyway, because our robot tended to not stop after autonomous and drive off.
Speaking of autonomous, isn't there a second type of match for the VEX game? Wasn't it autonomous only?
Yeah, I believe it's 2 30-second autonomous periods, right, John?
Actually, yeah. The way the VEX competition is set up this year is you have both operator-controlled and autonomous matches that are completely separate matches. It's an interesting way to get more matches in for every team in a one-day event cycle. And it's also pretty cool because of the way they put an added emphasis on the autonomous matches. Actually, in the VEX, the seeding is your average of your operator-controlled scores and your autonomous match scores. So if you have the best autonomous scores and you're seeded first autonomously and you're dead last in operator control, you're going to come out somewhere in the middle. And if you're really good at operator control and you seed first, but your autonomous isn't there, you're not going to be at the top of the pack. So if you want to be a picking team in this game, it seems like you're going to have both sides of the coin ready.
Now, about the autonomous modes, I'm wondering, I mean, I've got my own VEX kit now. I'm playing with it. There's no competition port, obviously, on the transmitter. How do you control disabling and autonomous modes on these things?
Well, that's something they're actually working on right now. I think the way it's going to be for the final competition is, basically, we're going to give every team some code where you can install a jumper in your digital I.O., and that will let the RC know you intend this to be an autonomous match. And then, basically, as soon as you enable power, it'll go right into autonomous mode for the set time. And you guys will forgive me if I'm wrong here, but I am a mechanical engineer, so I'll do the best I can.
I'm sorry to stress your mechy routines here, but I gotta wonder also about the disabling. How does that work? My guess is since the transmitters are actually tethered to the field computers, it just stops transmitting?
Yeah, I believe it works such that you kill power to the transmitter and through the tether cables again, and that just disables the robots, and that's part of the master code.
One last thing, though. I mean, is there any way that, let's say, your match ends, could you just, if you want to be really sneaky and evil and not GP, unplug your tether cable and keep something powered to hold it in a certain position?
Again, I'm not a programming guy, but I believe that our people would find out a way to keep you from doing that. And certainly, we hope that no one would take that approach. I mean, no one likes a team that cheats.
All right, so this year's VEX game, it seems really interesting. Do you think we're going to see a big variety in robots? I mean, it is the pilot season, and VEX is still pretty new, so I don't know. I'm not sure if we're going to see anything spectacular. What do you think?
I think we're going to see the same kind of variety we would see in FRC or FLL. I mean, looking at the racquetball as a game object, it's kind of interesting because, you know, there's many ways to pick up a racquetball. There's many ways to hold it, to score it. I think it's an interesting design challenge. Certainly, they've got a high goal that's 18 inches tall, while the robots can only start 12 inches tall. So we're going to see some interesting mechanisms there for scoring. We're going to see some interesting drive systems for going up the ramps. I mean, we've already seen VEX swerve drives, VEX shifting transmissions. Kudos to you, Matt, for your shifting transmission.
Thanks.
I'm expecting a lot of variety, and I'm excited to see what everyone comes up with.
Now, that actually reminds me of another question. I haven't had a chance to go through the rules much, but do you have to use only the starter kit, or are you allowed to use the add-on kits? Because if a team wanted to use, say, a shifting transmission, I can tell you there's not enough parts in the kit to build more than one.
Well, again, you can read the manual for the specific material usage rules, but I believe that right now, the only restrictions are on motors. You're only allowed 8 motors or servos. You're only allowed 1 brain. So the processing power is a little limited. And there's a size restriction. I think it's 18 by 18 by 12 tall. And then beyond that, you're allowed any official VEX component. And there's also a small laundry list of additional components. I think you're allowed Velcro, an anti-slip pad, and some nylon rope. But again, the restrictions are mostly based on the size and the limitations of the motors. I mean, you build a 20-pound robot, those VEX motors aren't going to be able to move it. That's the major design restriction right there.
Okay, so instead of imposing a weight restriction this year, first is just relying on the fact the motors can't move a lot?
Well, it's self-limiting, Matt. I mean, they could have put a weight restriction on it, but I'm not sure if it would have added anything. I mean, the VEX challenge already is a tough thing. You design these little robots, and it's a challenge to get them to do the kind of stuff you're wanting to. It's incredibly versatile. The VEX kit is a great thing as far as that, but it's still not easy.
Plus, you're pretty much limited to the starter kits, and the starter kits themselves aren't exactly that heavy. I got to see the one that our team got the other day, and it's pretty light. And since they're pretty much limiting it to only VEX official components, they really can't amass to that much on a few other things. But still, you can't really fit that much mass and that much space.
Well, it's not necessarily about the mass, but there are limitations there. I mean, and actually there are... You're talking as though the only VEX products out there are the VEX starter kit. If you go on RadioShack.com and search VEX, they've got a whole lot of accessory kits out now. The Omni-Wheel kits, the Tank Tread kits, Sprockets and Chain, Enhanced Gear kits. They've got all kinds of new sensors out now, which is pretty cool. And actually on VEXLabs.com, which is the Innovation First supply site, we've got all kinds of new prototype kits coming out. And those prototype kits are considered official VEX components because they could someday be sold through RadioShack. I know we've got a couple different types of metal coming out that are gonna open things wide up. It should be pretty cool. Again, I'm excited to see where this goes.
Well, this VEX stuff looks like it's shaping up to be a pretty big contender for the FRC competition. I think it's going to be exciting this year. I hope to see some really interesting designs. That's pretty much it for our VEX section. But I'm sure JVN's got some other stuff to talk about, especially the kitbot last year. I wanted to ask you about that, actually. Last year, it came out pretty well. I liked it a lot. I liked the transmissions a lot. Are we going to see that again this year? Or are we planning any major changes for it? Or?
Well, Matt, you know, no one has any pre-knowledge of the first kit of parts. We'll see what comes out in January. I know I was excited by the success of the kitbot last season. We were real impressed by the ways teams used it. We saw teams that used the kitbot for mechanisms. We saw, you know, teams who had robots built out of pretty much nothing with the sheet metal components from the kitbot chassis. Again, I was happy to kind of give away some of my tricks of the trade so that a lot of the inexperienced teams out there could be more successful. I know it was great competing against teams on a higher level. The great thing about that was you walked around at regionals and you saw very few teams that weren't moving, which was different from previous years. I know we used the kitbot chassis as part of our robot on 229, and the transmissions were used by lots of teams, including some of our national champions. That was really impressive. Paul Copioli was the primary designer behind the kitbot transmission, and he did just a bang-up job. Kudos to Paul.
Ah, so Paul's the one working on the transmission. I actually had a question about that, too. I'm hoping you might still be able to answer it. Do you know why Paul went with the metric shaft on the output? Because I know that got us a little messed up. We were going to order different sprockets, but we couldn't actually find ones to match the shaft.
Paul works for Fanuc Robotics, which is a robotics company that their primary units is metric. So he designs pretty much all in metric. The Thunder Chicken's robots are pretty much all in metric, and that's just the way it came out. The question was brought before the design committee about whether to use metric or English for some of the stuff, and it was decided that we wanted first teams to get the experience of learning how to integrate the two different components and working together. I mean, there were sprockets available through Innovation First if you wanted them, or you can just buy a metric drill and brooch set. We really didn't see it as that big a challenge. I know that's the thing I get more complaints than anything about, but, you know, deal with it.
Words of wisdom from a great firster. When problems arise, just deal with them. All right, so moving on, though. I believe we got some mailbag questions, at least one this week. Guys?
Sure, I'll bring this up. It comes from William Leverett, a mentor from Team 1293, D5 Robotics, known as Bill Fred on the Chief Delphi forums. He writes, "Greetings, y'all. I've got a question for the masses. What's a good trick for sticking to the carpet and cutting down on wheel spin?"
I'd have to say flattening out your pneumatic tires seems to be the simplest solution.
Yeah, if you're using pneumatic tires, definitely flatten them out. We had them on our 2004 robot, and I noticed there was a difference with a flatter tire than a less flat tire. Also, change your treads, too. Different treads get different results, right?
Yeah, different treads do get different results, but about the pneumatic tire thing, watch your battery life. We noticed that when we deflated ours from 2004 robot, our battery life went from 3 matches to just barely 1. It could just be the extra load brought on by the fact that most of the torque isn't going to nowhere. But I don't know.
You're increasing the inefficiency of the system and increasing the load on the motors, which, you know, results in a higher current draw, which results in the battery draining faster. That's what it basically boils down to. On 229, we always strive for a higher efficiency drivetrain, so we tend to stick to the hard wheels with the conveyor belt. But certainly, the deflating pneumatic tires is a good solution. Design is an iterative process. I mean, if you have time in the preseason or even during the 6 weeks to test different material types and test different wheel types, you should definitely go about doing that, because, I mean, you never know when you're going to find that one solution that'll put you over the top. We played with different tread types, and we actually used the rough top conveyor belting tread from McMaster Kart, which was, you know, the pricing is relatively inexpensive, and it works out pretty good for us. It's easy to mount on your wheels, easy to change out. So we're very happy with that, and I would use that again in the future.
All right, I've got another question from David, also known as Sandrag, from Team 696 on Chief Delphi. He says, in first, there are veteran teams that have been with a program for many years yet have never been to the championship. Why don't they go? And can you describe what they're missing out on? Is a championship as good as all the hype makes it out to be?
It's a pretty obvious answer. Anyone who's been to Atlanta or any competition like that will tell you that there is no experience that can match it. It is definitely a lot of fun. I'm sure everyone else here can say that is a lot of fun, right?
Yeah, definitely a lot of fun. I can tell you that much.
One of the misconceptions there is that veteran team means a team that's been successful since the beginning. Whereas veteran team really means they've just been competing for a long time. So even though they've been competing, you know, most teams, you know, don't have the, well, I can't say most, but a lot of teams don't have the funds to be able to do, say, if you're on the West Coast, to do a regional there and then be able to fly all the way to the East Coast to the championships. So just because they're veteran doesn't mean that they have the funding. It doesn't mean that they're any less of a team. I'm sure there's great teams on the West Coast. I don't happen to be as familiar with them because I'm on the East Coast, obviously. But a veteran team, I think, only really means that they've been in it for a while, not that they've been successful all the time.
The championship event is certainly an incredible experience. I love going. I've been to all of them except one in the years I've competed in first. It's a fun thing to go be a part of. But again, the regional experience is great too. And a lot of teams, when they weigh the pros and cons of going to the championship or going to an extra regional or two extra regionals, will choose the regionals. I mean, and again, like Jeff said, sometimes the funding and the resources aren't there, and teams just have to make compromises based on what they have to work with.
Also, we have this week's tip for you all. As me and John were discussing before with the metric shaft on the transmissions, integrating metric and English onto your robot, it's probably becoming more and more common. I know it is on my team. Check your math all the time. Check your conversions. And also, we mentioned this before. I just want to mention again to check your conversions. Check all your math. Check your gear ratios. Check everything. I can, personally speaking, in 2004, my team designed a two-speed shifting dog-style transmission. It worked great, except for the fact that its low gear was 12 feet per second, and it could not get the robot moving without a good, healthy shove. So it's still sitting on our shelf, and we keep that around as a reminder to check our math all the time.
Okay, so any last words before we sign off?
I just want to thank you guys for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure. I'm sorry if I couldn't answer some of your questions to what you wanted, but, you know, some secrets need to be kept till kickoff.
Same here. Thanks for having me on, and if any of you guys want to come to Dayton, just drop me a line, and I'll be happy to meet with you and answer any questions.
Yeah, we would like to thank you guys for coming on the show. Good job. Hope to see you around. Yeah, very good job, guys.
Yeah, thanks again, guys. I seem to be becoming a somewhat regular on the show, so I'm sure I will see you again.
I've been told I need to make sure everyone knows that I am the real John V. Noon, not one of the many imposters.
Are you calling me an imposter, John?
Me too.
We are all the real John V. Noon, and we're wrapping this up. This is Matt Kress signing off.
And this is Adam Richards with a broken mic signing off.
Thanks to everyone. Joe for the college stuff, Jeff, our resident professor, and of course, the artificial John V. Noon.
We cloned him for the show, everyone. Don't listen to him what he says.
See you guys sometime soon. Connor Ryan signing off.